Welcome back to Run the List, a medical education podcast in internal medicine. As a quick disclaimer, this podcast is made for educational and informational purposes only and should not be understood as medical advice under any circumstances. Before we get to the show, a quick word on the sponsors for today's episode.
This episode is brought to you by Open Evidence. Open Evidence is a really incredible resource for people in medicine. It's an AI-powered medical information platform that can help you answer clinical questions, provide high-quality literature, and so much more. You can ask questions like, what are the classic imaging findings for gout? Or, tell me about the landmark trials in lupus nephritis. They recently partnered with the New England Journal of Medicine, so they have access to their text, figures, and tables within Open Evidence. It's free and unlimited for healthcare professionals, so I highly encourage you to go check it out. Go to openevidence.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Run the List. Today, we will be discussing another high-yield topic for primary care and GI clinic, and that is celiac disease. We are again so lucky to have Dr. Sith Saker joining us as our expert. Dr. Saker is a general gastroenterologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and soon-to-be gastroenterology hospitalist who has a particular interest in medical education. Sith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Devin. It's great to be back on the Run the List podcast and to help teach about this very important topic today with you.
Same here, Sith. Let's go ahead and run the list. Let's set the stage in GI clinic. You are seeing a 34-year-old healthy female with a history of iron deficiency anemia who is presenting with bloating, a change in her stool quality, and fatigue. She recalls being told to start an iron supplement in the past, but that it did not improve her fatigue or her blood count. Her family history is notable for type 1 diabetes in her mother, and on exam, you note skin pallor and a mildly distended abdomen with hyperactive bowel sounds and slight tenderness in the upper abdomen. Sith, given that case presentation, what differential diagnosis comes to mind and how would you approach the initial workup?
Yeah, I think the differential is pretty broad with this presentation. I think the first thing that really comes to my mind would be celiac disease. A couple things really sort of stand out to me, I think. The iron deficiency anemia that's refractory to supplementation is one thing. The family history of the type 1 diabetes, which increases the risk of celiac disease. And I think that would be the number one thing that comes to my mind. Other things to consider would be things like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis could present like this, and then IBSD in general. But I think celiac is sort of at the top, especially with iron, especially when you think about 3 to 5% of patients with iron deficiency anemia have celiac disease, and then the refractory to oral supplementation, especially where celiac affects in the duodenum and the jejunum, where iron is absorbed. And then, you know, some basic workup I would get would be things like CBC, TSH, celiac serologies, and then fecal calprotectin, especially to evaluate that change in her stool quality.
All right, Sith, that's a great starting point. And I love the emphasis on the iron deficiency anemia that is not improving with PO iron supplementation, which suggests that there could be some issue with malabsorption. And that's kind of hinting to you that this could be celiac disease. All right. So, Sith, you mentioned celiac serologies. Can you discuss specifically what serologies you send? I know we talk about them in general, but what do you specifically send and why are those the labs that you send?
Yeah, I think when we send celiac serologies, the big one that we're looking at is TTG IgA. That's sort of the best combination of sensitivity and specificity for celiac disease. The important thing to know about that is that you need to also check the IgA level as well, and then also need to ask if the patient is still taking gluten. A lot of these patients, by the time they get to you, they've tried a lot of different dietary modifications, including stopping gluten. So it's really important to ask about if they're still consuming gluten because that can really affect the testing.
Perfect. I've also had the situation where a patient has gotten a positive celiac serology and then they were advised to stop eating gluten right away. And then by the time they get to GI clinic, as you mentioned, we're left in the situation where they had a positive celiac serology, but now they're on a gluten-free diet. And so we'll talk about that in a bit, what we need to do in that case. But getting back to what you just discussed, so what happens if you send the tissue transglutaminase IgA level along with the IgA level and the IgA level comes back undetectable? What do you do with that result?
Yeah, I think that's sort of, you know, why you send IgA, because you want to make sure there's no IgA deficiency, because if it comes back undetectable and there is deficiency, then the TTG IgA is not reliable at all. And in that case, then you would use IgG trans-tissue glutaminase instead. Or you can use any other sort of IgG-based test, sort of like a deaminated gliadin protein testing. But when it comes back and there's IgA deficiency, then you want to choose more of a route of an IgG testing for it. That's sort of where I would go when it's an IgA deficiency.
Okay, great. So nice teaching point there to always send the IgA level, the total IgA level, with any TTG IgA celiac test. And then getting back to the scenario in which a patient comes to you on a gluten-free diet, but at some point had an elevated TTG, IgA, or other celiac serology. Sith, how do you think about working up those patients who have already started a gluten-free diet but had a positive celiac serology as part of their workup?
Yeah, I think the next test I really think about is sort of genetic testing. And, you know, luckily we have some pretty good genes that we mapped to celiac, and that would be HLA DQ2 and DQ8. And these are sort of really helpful because if negative, you know, they're very, very sensitive. So if negative, you can exclude celiac in these cases. If positive, it's not as helpful. You sort of still have to go down the pathway, but it being negative can exclude the celiac. So if it is positive and you're in that case where they've already started a gluten-free diet, then we would ask, you know, to re-challenge gluten, which can be difficult for patients, for at least 2 weeks and then repeat serology. And gluten challenge is sort of trying to eat about 1 to 3 pieces of bread a day for sort of those 2 weeks or 4 weeks before repeating serologies or other testing, including endoscopy, which we'll talk about coming up.
Excellent. All right. That was super helpful to review those situations as they do come up, I have to say, with some frequency. All right. So let's say our patient is consuming gluten, and the initial labs are notable for a mild anemia. We'll say it's microcytic with a hemoglobin of 11, and the TTG IgA returns significantly elevated at 500 units per milliliter. And you did check the IgA level, and that was normal. So what is the next step in diagnosis for this patient?
Yeah, the next step is to proceed to an upper endoscopy. And it's important that the patient remains on gluten so you can get the best sort of testing from biopsies. And you want to take duodenal biopsies, multiple. We usually try to get at least 6, and we want to get it both from the bulb, which is the first part of the duodenum, as well as more from the distal duodenum. And actually, celiac preferably affects the more distal duodenum, so we try to get more of our pieces from there and sort of look for things on pathology that are consistent with celiac.
Perfect, Sith. Yeah, that's such a good point about the biopsying approach. And so one thing I do, I know you do it as well, is I indicate in my procedure report that I've obtained biopsies both from the duodenal bulb and the more distal duodenum. And like you said, to get more from the distal duodenum, because that's often where the celiac disease is presenting itself. So, all right. So now some cases, we will see these discordant results where the celiac serology is positive, but then the biopsies come back normal. So in those situations, Sith, what's your approach? What are you thinking are the possibilities?
Yeah, I think in those cases, you can either have a false positive of the TTG. It's less likely, especially if the titers are high, or you more likely will get false negative biopsies because celiac is just so patchy. And that's why we get so many biopsies from the duodenum. I think this is an excellent sort of use case for the genetic testing of the HLA DQ2 and DQ8. Similarly as before, if it's negative, you can exclude celiac in these cases. If it is positive, as it most likely will be, then you can perform more intensive gluten challenge, have them, you know, eat sort of 3 pieces of toast for about 1 to 3 months, and then continue to eat that and then repeat the EGD after sort of about 3 months. And sometimes you even need them on a gluten challenge for up to 6 to 12 months before repeating the EGD.
Wow. So that HLA DQ2 DQA testing, again, comes in very handy in this discordant result scenario. All right. So Sith, that was a great review. Let's get back to our case. So our patient undergoes an upper endoscopy while continuing to consume gluten. The endoscopist notes a scalloped appearance of the duodenal mucosa, which is suggestive of celiac disease. And then the biopsies of the duodenal bulb and the second part of the duodenum are obtained. You receive the pathology report that indicates that the biopsies noted significant villus blunting and increased intraepithelial lymphocytes, which in combination with her significantly elevated TTG IgA confirms her diagnosis of celiac disease. With that, Sith, can you conclude our episode today on the approach to diagnosis of celiac disease with some RTL pearls?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the biggest thing is sort of when you think about celiac disease, I think number one, anytime you have a patient with iron deficiency anemia, celiac disease should be something you screen for with serologies. Other things can be sort of non-specific GI symptoms as well. We often see people with bloating can present with celiac disease, and then even sort of food sensitivities and even sort of diarrhea can also present as celiac disease. So just having a high suspicion and screening for it with serologies is important. And then in terms of workup, you want to send the TTG IgA, and anytime you're sending that, you want to send the total IgA as well to screen for IgA deficiency. And as prior, if there is IgA deficiency, then you want to use an IgG modality, either TTG IgG, or you want to use the deaminated gliadin protein IgG. And then in these discordant results where you have serology that's positive, biopsy negative, or even sometimes you get biopsies that are positive and the celiac serologies are negative, then you can use the HLA-DQ2, DQ8 genetic testing to see if negative, it excludes celiac disease. If positive, then you need to do more testing. And then the biggest thing and sort of the thing that we see very often actually in GI clinics that is really important for the patients to continue on gluten until their diagnostic upper endoscopy, because that really increases the diagnostic yield of biopsies.
Thank you, Sith. Those are awesome pearls. I think you gave us one extra. We usually do three and you gave us a bonus one. So thank you for all that. I had an awesome time discussing with you how to diagnose celiac disease, and I look forward to having you back to discuss the management of celiac disease very soon.
Look forward to being back on.
Thanks so much, Sith. And to our RTL listeners, thank you for coming for another episode, and we'll see you soon.